Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Buffy St. Marie has achieved many things throughout her career, including making history and recording it. In 1969, only after a few years of coming to prominence in the Greenwich Village folk scene, she released an electronic album. Its use of synthesized vocals and early surround sound technology wouldn't be adopted into mainstream music for years. In the 1970s, she joined the cast of Sesame Street, and in that role, she was one of the few indigenous people that many kids and their parents would see on TV. Her role in the show also led her to become the first person to breastfeed on national TV in 1977. In 1983, she became the first indigenous person to receive an Oscar for co-writing the song Up Where We Belong from An Officer and a Gentleman, and in 1992, she broke musical boundaries again as one of the first artists to release an album made by sending files over the internet. Over her career, Buffy has also used her music to educate and activate. Through songs like Now That the Buffalo's Gone and My Country, Tis of Thy People, You're Dying, and of course, her first big hit, Universal Soldier.
He's 5 foot two and he's 6 feet four. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years.
Having just celebrated her 80th birthday, now the musician's inspiring life is recorded in Buffy St. Marie, the authorized biography, written by music journalist Andrea Warner, and now out in paperback. Joining me from her home in Hawaii is Buffy St. Marie. Buffy, thank you for joining us again.
Hi, Allison. How's everybody?
Everybody's great. How's everybody in your world?
Pretty good. Very far away. Been quarantining for a long, long time.
I think there is light on the horizon. Fingers crossed. There's a point in the book where you describe yourself as being like a journalist reading the news, the idea that songwriting as journalism comes up a lot. When you first started songwriting, was that part of your mission in the beginning, or is that something that just developed?
Oh, gosh, a little of both, I think. I never would have characterized it like that in the beginning, but looking back on it, it's kind of what it was. I had graduated from the University of Massachusetts with a degree in Oriental philosophy and another degree in teaching. And I had no idea I'd wind up in show business. But the songs that I had to sing, you know, it was kind of the emerging folk music movement. And there were real folk singers around, but I wasn't one of them. Mm-hmm. I was a songwriter, and it wasn't exactly legitimate yet to write your own songs, let alone to be writing about the issues that I was interested in. There weren't any, it was long before the American Indian Movement, or there weren't really any Native American people prominent in North American culture or in world culture. So the things that I had to say, particularly in my songs that dealt with indigenous issues, were brand new. So I felt as though it was real important to write my songs almost like I had done at the university when I wanted to get an A from some professor who, number one, didn't like my topic, number two, didn't know much about me, and number three, thought that I was going to flunk. So I wanted to write an A paper. And so I wanted to, in 3 minutes, give people something that they couldn't get somewhere else. And I knew it needed to be column space. You know, it needed to get a lot of information into a quick amount of time. And I was reaching an audience for whom the information was new. So that's why I kind of thought of, when I look back on it, it's a little bit more like journalism than just being an entertainer.
Why do you think music is a good delivery system for the kind of messages that you wanted to send?
Oh, really? Because it is entertaining. You know, I mean, It doesn't have to be just pure show business, but the fact that it can be. I mean, I feel as though a songwriter can in a 3-minute song, we can reach people immediately in a way that's replicable, that's entertaining, that catches your attention. You can say as much in a 3-minute song if you're good at it, as it'll take somebody else a 400-page textbook to write. You know, so it's the immediacy and the fact that it's replicable, the fact that a song can be done, you know, it can be translated easily into many, many languages. Universal Soldier and Until It's Time for You to Go, especially, have been translated into lots of different languages and been used in many different ways. And that's one of the things I think a songwriter can do.
My guest is Buffy St. Marie. The name of the book is Buffy St. Marie, The Authorized Biography. There's this great description of you as a kid in the book where you said you particularly loved the winter season. I drop my books at home, grab my skates, go down the hill to the lake and skate until dark, hearing Tchaikovsky in my head, as well as Elvis, Fats Domino, Little Richard, Jerry Lee, Laverne Baker, and Chuck Berry. So that's quite a mix of influences and people that you loved. Is there anything that all of those folks have in common for you specifically?
I don't know, but Andrea Warner is such a good writer, and she's such a funny writer, too. She kind of captured it. When I was a kid, you know, I first saw a piano when I was about 3, and I never played sports, and I've never played Barbie dolls, and the kids in my neighborhood were bullies, so I had a whole lot of fun just making art, and it was never work for me. It was always play. So what I could play anything that I heard on the radio. I'm dyslexic in music, it turns out, so I never have been able to learn how to sight read. Anything that I'd hear in the radio that my parents had playing, you know, I could play it immediately. And then when rhythm and blues and rock and roll came along and I was, I don't know, 12, 13, 14, I just loved it. And everybody that you mentioned, I mean, Little Richard was my hero. Elvis Presley was my god. And I used to get on the train and go to New York. And to Boston. I was living in Maine. And I saw the Alan Freed rock and roll shows. And so here was this kid who had a love for music and a phonographic head. You know, I could play anything that I heard. And when I saw it in terms of 3-minute songs and a band and rhythm and blues and rock and roll, here were all these untrained, unschooled musicians putting on a show that I just adored. So I think I was really very fortunate in not having been pounded out of my love for music by some teacher who wouldn't have understood that although I could play fake Tchaikovsky from the time I was 3, I never could learn how to read music. And I think that many, many of the world's great musicians also cannot read music. As a matter of fact, one time I was in Nashville, and Chet Atkins had invited me to Nashville. And Chet Atkins, in case anybody doesn't know, Chet Atkins is an incredible musician, guitar player, you know, just any kind of music you could think of, you know, far beyond country and well into jazz. And I told him that, you know, some of the boys who were in bands, they'd give me the business because I couldn't read music. And he said, Buffy, he said, you know what I say when somebody asks me if I can read music? And I said, no, what? And he said, not enough to hurt my playing. And I think the public has an idea that, you know, musicians have to spend 16 years studying European composers in order to make music. But it's not like that. There are 360 degrees of ways to be a musician, and reading music is one of them, and playing by ear is another.
Do you remember the moment when you realized this is what I'm going to do for my life's work? I'm going to be a musician.
Oh gosh, I think I'm still trying to get there. I got real lucky right away. You know, I went from the University of Massachusetts to Greenwich Village, and all of a sudden I had offers to play here and there, not only in the village, and I used to play in the Gaslight a lot, but all over town, and, you know, I'd get on a bus and I'd go to other places. I'd go to Toronto, I'd go to Florida, and that was a big deal for me coming from Maine, you know, to go to Florida in February. So I liked show business. I liked that part. You could get out of town and have a life. And really, you know, because I, number one, I didn't come from what I'll call legitimate music, you know, people who really have control of a music literature, like a classically trained or jazz trained person. I was not really literate in music, so it was fun for me, as it had been from the start. And, you know, I entered New York show business at a funny time. The window was very narrowly opened for a while. You know, we were coming out of the Eisenhower years and into the Kennedy years, and students were all over the streets. We had discovered our brains. We weren't going to go to somebody's damn war. And yet, what was being sung mostly was, you know, kind of Woody Guthrie things, like, you know, wonderful songs about, you know, coal miners and unions, that just great, great songs. But also there was the one that I would always get stuck with, "This land is your land, this land is my land," or like my friend the comedian Charlie Hill used to say, "This land is your land, this land used to be my land." And people at that time, even Pete Seeger, God bless him, and isn't he wonderful, it took 40 years for him to understand why I didn't want to sing that song in the finale of a show that we were doing.
My guest is Buffy St. Marie. The name of the book is Buffy St. Marie, the authorized biography written by Andrea Warner. We'll have more with Buffy after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest this hour is Buffy St. Marie. And Buffy, it's so interesting that the title of your first album with your big hit, Universal Soldier, is It's My Way. It's a little sadly ironic because we learned in the book that you really didn't get your way with that first release, and that you wrote, said that you were heartbroken a bit with that album. What were you unhappy with on that album?
Oh, I think I was just shocked as to the takes that the record company had chosen. I felt as though I just would have chosen different takes. I think that they probably thought that I was a young person lost in addiction who wasn't going to survive. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was it, or I don't know. That could be just my imagination, but. I just didn't like how it sounded, and I felt as though the emotion of the songs was all, you know, just indisputable, you know, because I was singing from reality and from my heart. But I was a little disappointed as to how I sounded and which takes were chosen. But, you know, what I did on the not liking how I sounded, I just had to learn how to sing differently. And the only way that I had the courage to get on a stage in the first place was because of the songs. I really believed in the content of the songs, and I knew that I was writing songs that, you know, Joan Baez and Judy Collins weren't going to sing them, you know, so who's left? Me, you know? I hadn't yet introduced Joni Mitchell to the world, which was a pleasure that I had a little bit later on, but... as a songwriter, I was writing such unusual things. I was the only one who knew the songs. Otherwise, you know, if I could have gotten somebody else to sing my albums, I would have. And since I didn't like how I sounded, I learned how to sing in a little bit different way. I just started listening to myself differently. And, you know, just when you're only concentrating on the message, it might not sound like you wanted it to sound once you listen back. So I don't know. I just had a lot to learn.
You mentioned Joni Mitchell, and she wrote the foreword for your biography, and she writes about how you were a big help to her. You know, you were a young woman on your own trying to make it. Why was it important for you to try to help another young artist? I mean, you used to carry around her demo tapes when she was just starting out.
I did. You know, she's from Saskatchewan, and so am I. And I just thought she was really good, and she couldn't get a break. Meanwhile, I was, you know, in 1964, when my first album came out, I was Billboard's best new artist. I was on magazine covers. You know, I was making movies in Hollywood and trying to get people to employ Indians, which is kind of a funny story we can talk about later on if you want. But Joni, I thought Joni was fantastic. She, you know, I was using all these wacky tunings, and eventually she was too, and I took that as a compliment, and she was a great songwriter. She was also absolutely beautiful, and I thought she was a great singer. But nobody wanted to hear her, so I did. It's true. I carried Joni's tape around for a long time. I played it for Vanguard. I played it for other artists. I played it for management people. And eventually I played it for Elliot Roberts, who was a junior agent in my manager's office. And nobody else wanted to hear her. They just told me, why don't you shut up about this other person and start working on your own career? So anyway, Joni and I sent Elliot Roberts down to hear Joni, and he did, and they made a great career together. So, you know, talking about the rest is history.
So, Buffy, you started in folk, and you also have a country album. I believe it was your fifth album. And then you followed that up with Illuminations, which is now considered a milestone in electronic music for using synthesizers and quadraphonic sound. So can you explain to us or fill us in on your thought process about going from folk to country to electronic music, why you wanted to try so many different genres?
Oh, gosh, it just came naturally to me. All of my albums, from my first to my most recent, the only thing they have in common is that the songs are really diverse one to another. And in the record business, that's not smart. You know, notice a Motown album, for instance. Every song has the same musicians, the same feel, you know, usually the same artists, same backup singers. They have a lot in common. But mine didn't. And there were some, you know, there was more diversity in albums in those days. But mine was highly diverse. And all I'm saying is that I was interested in all kinds of music. I didn't care. I mean, my first album had a song that I sang in Hindi, which is a language from India. But I was an Oriental philosophy major, and I loved that song, and it made sense to me, so I put it on the album. Universal Soldier has nothing in common with It's My Way, and they have nothing in common with, you know, some of the love songs that are on that album. So all I can say is that playing different styles of music is just the same thing I'm doing within an album or in a concert, where, I don't know, for me, each song is its own little movie. Mm-hmm. And together, for instance, in a concert, they make a certain kind of sense, even though the songs themselves may vary from style to style, or, you know, what instrument I'm playing, or whether I have a band or not. I never really have gone along with genres. Genres are helpful in the music business, in the business side. Mm-hmm. You know, they know what bin to put you in. They put you aside hoping to attract people who are interested in a certain kind of music. But to the artist, sometimes it just doesn't matter much. It's like if you take a camera out on a trip that you're taking and you take pictures of all kinds of things. There aren't any rules as to what you think is wonderful.
My guest is Buffy St. Marie. The name of the book is Buffy St. Marie, the authorized biography written by Andrea Warner. In the first chapter of the book, Buffy, it begins, to be born Cree in the 1940s in Canada was to be a person who was not always counted. What does that mean?
I think what Andrea is referring to are this, partly the census. Also, in my case, where I think I may have been born, there was a fire that wiped out 6 years' worth of records. And there's a woman named Jean Cuthand who was one of the first nurses in Saskatchewan, and you know, she's also Cree, and she never could find her proper birth certificate. So I think Andrea is probably referring to two things. You know, one, just the specific facts of where I happened to be born, and secondly, the fact that in what Canada has come to call the 60s scoop, or the big scoop, which mm-hmm. happened well before the 60s, a lot of us were taken away from our own homes and either stuck in residential schools or just given to the adoption system, you know, hundreds of thousands of kids. We don't talk about it in the U.S., but we do talk about it in Canada. It happened in the U.S. too. But growing up without a birth certificate and growing up as an adopted child, I mean, you don't even have a horoscope. The records are sealed. You have a birthday assigned by the courts. And, you know, it's just a little bit different way to live your life than most people go through.
When you were growing up, growing up in Maine and Massachusetts, you've mentioned, how much did you know about where you were from?
I didn't know anything about where I was from.
Hmm.
I never have known. I think a lot of adopted children are that way.
You
don't really know. I tried real hard. You know, when I was making enough money and traveling enough to, you know, do things like go places and take days off and hire lawyers, I tried all kinds of ways to find out, you know, everything that I could determine. But like most adoptive kids, you don't really know. You know, if you were making a movie about an adoption, it would all be very official. But now I know more about my cats who come from the shelter than I do about myself growing up.
My guest is Buffy St. Marie. The name of the book is Buffy St. Marie, The Authorized Biography by Andrea Warner. You know, it was interesting at the beginning of our conversation, you were talking a lot about, we were talking about how music can be like journalism, but it also is a form of education. And I know that's something that's really important to you. And you founded your own education initiative, the Cradle Board Teaching Project. What was the original intention for it?
Well, you know, I got a lot of education. I've been very fortunate. The University of Massachusetts was absolutely wonderful. And, you know, I've gone on for more education. But I knew real early, my mom even told me when I was a kid, that what you see on television and in movies isn't necessarily so. And when you grow up, you can go out and find out. And when I was a young singer traveling around, I not only knew that Indigenous people have a real hard time negotiating the path between high school and college. They don't know how to get into college, and they certainly didn't in the 60s and the 70s. So I also found out that, for instance, after a concert, teachers would come to me and they'd say, well, where can I find out more about American Indian people or Indigenous people? And, you know, I'd recommend some books. And anyway, what I recognized was a gap. It's really a gap, and there's two sides to it. One, mainstream teachers can't find accurate, enriching teaching materials. They don't know. I mean, they're required by law to teach an Indian unit, but there's no materials. Well, how are they supposed to do it? And I'm a teacher. I know how hard that is. And on the other hand, Indigenous people, we suffer all our lives by the fact that, you know, we've been erased, by the fact that we don't exist in most people's worlds. We don't exist in most people's worlds. We're just absent. We're just invisible. So with the Cradle Boy Teaching Project, that came out of an initiative when I was a young singer with too much money. I started something called the Nihiwan Foundation for American Indian Education. And what I did first was to put people through college. And my proudest day wasn't when I won my Academy Award. It was when I found out that two of my early scholarship recipients had gone on to become the founders and presidents of tribal colleges in Native communities. You know, I found that out years later. So what I did with the foundation, besides making scholarships, was I developed this thing, and we ran it for, about 20 years. It's not happening right now. It's called the Cradle Board Teaching Project, and I really wanted, I was really doing the same thing that I was doing on Sesame Street or in my songs. I was providing the information that wasn't available. And I connected schools on reservations with schools far away on the other side of the country, Canada and the U.S., and the two schools would study together, one an Indigenous school and the other any kind of mainstream school. And I wrote an entirely new curriculum, science through Native American eyes, government, social studies through Native American eyes. And it was very, very beautifully supported by the Kellogg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, many other helpers. So we ran that for quite a long time, and we were connecting kids on the reservation with kids who were on non-reservations, and the kids got to know each other through studying this new curriculum, not about one little, two little, three little Indians, or the Navajos were over there, and the Apaches were over there, always in the past, always distant. So we made it very, very personal. We brought it all the way up to date, and people just loved it.
When we had you on the show back in December, I had mentioned that the Macy's Parade had just had its first land acknowledgement, and you talked about having hope even in these chaotic times. And it's only been a few months since then, but one major change is in the new administration. Deb Haaland, member of the Laguna Pueblo, is now Secretary of the Interior.
Yay! So
that's yay! First, I was going to ask your reaction to that. So that's yay is the reaction.
Yep. I sent her a bunch of checks. The only problem with having Deb be the secretary of the Interior is that who's going to take her place? We need two of her. That's really, really nice. And, you know, the land acknowledgement in Canada, says stuff like unceded territory for millennia. It's all in this damn lawyer talk. So when the Junos in Canada is like the Grammys, right? And I was opening the Junos a couple of years ago, and they wanted me to do a land acknowledgement. So I totally rewrote the thing, and I said, you know, we're on the unsurrendered territory, not unceded territory. Unceded, what is that? Sounds like tennis. It takes your mind off the subject while you figure out unceded. Does that mean you don't have a seat? We are in the unsurrendered territory. Nobody can mistake that. And not that we have looked after for millennia, but no, that we have looked after for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It just makes more sense to talk like a real person than to talk in, you know, small, cumbersome, obscure lawyer terms. When what we're trying to do really is to say something wonderful and bridge a gap.
I want to ask you one last question, and it's about your music. So in the book, because we learned so many interesting things in the book, and we learned that there's one song, I mean, you've had this incredible career. You've written powerful truth-telling songs. You've written beautiful love songs. You got an Academy Award for one of them. But you say there's one song that you single out as your favorite vocal of your whole career. Nobody will ever know it's real but you. Why do you like this vocal?
Oh, thank you for mentioning it. You're the only one who ever has. No, it's really, really obscure. It's this melody that the great bass player Norbert Putnam, he was a friend of mine in the 70s in Nashville, and he wrote the melody, and it was so beautiful. I was inspired to write words, and that's all there is to it. But I got to sing in a different way than I would sing on other songs, and I just always loved it, and it's so nice of you to mention that. By the way, I would really like to stick another plug in for Andrea Warner, because before I ever met Andrea, I had read the other book that she wrote about women in music, and it's called We Oughta Know, and it's about four Canadian women musicians who were really not taken seriously, even though they had the top four spots, you know, 1, 2, 3, and 4 in Canada. Disc jockeys would not play a woman back-to-back with another woman. And so it's about Alanis Morissette, Celine Dion, Shania Twain, and Sarah McLachlan. And boy, is it a lovely and funny book by Andrea Warner. It's called We Oughta Know.
So you can buy that book, and you can also buy this one, Buffy St. Marie, the authorized biography by Andrea Warner. Buffy, it is a pleasure, as always, to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, too, Allison. Hope to see you soon one of these days.
And we're going to go out on Nobody Will Ever Know It's Real But You.
Explodes and stops.